and welcome to Rabble Radio. It's Friday, September 8th, 2023. I'm your host, Brianne Doyle. Thanks so much for tuning in. Rabble's got its finger on the beat of the issues that matter to you. If you're curious about the latest news in Canadian politics, labor, environment, or social justice, you've come to the right place. This is news for the rest of us, free of corporate influence. This week on the show, national politics reporter Scott Martin sits down with Sean Smuckler. Sean Smuckler is an associate professor in applied biology and soil science at the University of British Columbia and the director of the Center for Sustainable Food Systems at the UBC Farm. Martin and Smuckler discuss the current challenges farmers are facing in Canada due to climate change and wonder aloud where Canada is headed. Here is that conversation. Take a listen.
Well, I want to thank you, Professor Smuckler, for taking the time to speak with us today. So I guess my first question is, a lot of Canadians who are east of Manitoba may not be aware of the agricultural situation that's going on out west. So can you briefly describe what the situation has been like over the past few years?
Yeah, it's been a roller coaster ride for BC farmers. The last few years have been, people use the word unprecedented. Quite commonly these days, but in fact, BC farmers, I think, are really exemplifying what that means. We're seeing floods, fires, droughts, heat domes, and these are all things that have long been predicted by scientists to be outcomes of a warming climate, and they're all happening quite rapidly here and now. And our farmers are reeling from 3 years of this quite astonishing climate pattern.
So when you say farmers are reeling from this situation, what has been, at least to your knowledge, like the impact on crops, on livestock, to farmers that has been so devastating?
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty commodity dependent. So, the British Columbia is an incredibly diverse agricultural system. We've got over 200 commodities being produced in very different climatic regions on different soil types. And the impacts of the weather patterns that we've been seeing are very diverse and regionally specific and crop specific. So, for example, we had a flood that impacted producers in the southwest region of the province. And that was quite devastating for perennial crop growers like blueberry producers or for the dairy producers in that region. In other parts of the province, we have farmers being or producers being impacted by wildfires. And those wildfires are impacting rangelands and the ranchers trying to produce cattle in those regions, but also some of the wine producers. We are just now trying to getting a grasp of what the impact of smoke is on crop production more broadly. So yeah, the impacts are variable, and we're just starting to get a handle on what they mean.
That's a wide range of effects that's happening, and of course, climate change is probably the biggest factor that people think of when this happens. And this, at least in my research, I can see that this is a direct result of it. Where do you see climate change going and the effects in the future or in the immediate present? What effects does it have on, say, a food consumer?
The food that people are wanting to buy. I mean, the reality is that much of our food in Canada comes from somewhere else. We were an amazing producer of food, but a lot of that is for export. Yeah, when we think about fruits and vegetables, a lot of that is coming from south of the border, and the impacts of climate change in places like California are actually greater than what we're seeing in BC. And expected to be worse. And so it's likely that we're going to see prices go up, but also some things just not being available when we expect them to be available. The plentiful grocery store experience that we've grown to love might not be consistent anymore.
So your work is mainly in mitigation of, you know, climate change and crop yields and things like that. So what methods and maybe new techniques are being used now to kind of accommodate to this, or are being developed for maybe accommodation in the future?
Yeah. So when we say mitigation, I'm specifically focused on reducing the emissions coming from agriculture and utilizing agriculture to sequester carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere in agricultural soils. I also focus on adaptation, so helping producers develop strategies to better deal with the changes that we're now seeing. So in terms of the mitigation aspects, we're focused on really trying to understand which practices are most likely to minimize the emissions that we're seeing. So right now, Canadian agriculture represents 10% of the national portfolio of greenhouse gas emissions. Agriculture represents a sizable portion of emissions nationally and internationally, and we really need to immediately turn off the tap. Like we've got to stop putting greenhouse gases into the atmosphere as soon as possible, and that means all sectors have to participate. And right now, the expectations of agriculture are fairly low, if non-existent, because the reality is farmers are already facing so many challenges, and we have to have food. So the trick is how do we develop strategies that won't further impact farmers' ability to produce food, but also gives us the possibility to actually meet our emission reduction targets, which are extremely ambitious at this point. So, you know, by 2030, we're trying to get emissions, you know, depending on what jurisdiction you're in, we're trying to get emissions somewhere around 45% below previous levels of, you know, depending on where you are, 2005, 2007 levels of emissions. And then by 2050, we're aiming to have net zero emissions. So, you know, as other sectors start to meet their emission reduction targets, agriculture is going to become a big culprit in the emission profile. So we've got to start working on strategies that reduce those emissions while also building the resiliency of the sector. Agriculture is already hard hit. It's going to be the hardest hit, likely, as the climate becomes more volatile. So, you know, one of the focus areas that I think will help meet emission reduction targets and also help build resiliency is focusing on soil health. Trying to help producers identify ways to improve soil health, pull carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere, while also building the capacity of their farming system to continue to operate in these volatile conditions.
It's interesting that you mentioned reductions specifically in agriculture to help, you know, tackle this problem. I was speaking with a couple farmers, and one of the techniques that they brought up was rotational grazing. For a quick summary, it's essentially allowing a herd to graze in an area until they're done and then move on to the next one and rotate. One of the comments they made was that, you know, this was a technique used by herd animals before Canada settler history. So techniques like that, is that enough? Is there more that needs to be done? And is this a practice that's even widely adopted in the industry?
Yeah, I mean, that's a very promising practice. The issue is whether or not it encourages having more animals on the landscape. I mean, the reality is that the majority of emissions coming from agriculture are coming from enteric fermentation from ruminant animals like cows. So while rotational grazing might do a great job in reducing those emissions by sequestering carbon in soil and maybe even reducing the emissions coming from the animals, it's not clear whether that's going to be enough to meet our emission targets or even the demand for meat. So, one of the reasons that we do have intensive animal production is to provide meat products to consumers who have a high demand for that and don't want to pay high prices.
So that's an interesting point. And, there's a lot of things that we can implement to maybe change the industry, but the societal attitude is something that's kind of a broader point. So just on that note, do you see government policies effectively tackling this right now? Are they helping these new techniques to be implemented? What are you seeing on that front from a policy standpoint?
I mean, the government is trying to do something. I want to encourage them to continue to develop policies that will address this problem. It is not enough, and it's not going to be rapid enough. So the amount of dollars that's going to address this situation is embarrassing. We are facing a climate emergency, and we're pretending like it's something that's for the next generation to deal with. No one grasps the fact that if we don't deal with it now, the next generation can't deal with it. So our policymakers are in a really precarious situation where they are trying to deal with something that the voters don't completely understand and aren't impacted by. And the constituents are a generation away.
I've had this conversation with a couple of other people about this subject, and it's hard not to sound alarmist when, looking at the current climate crisis and how it's impacting the agricultural situation. But this urgency keeps coming up. Do you feel that it's, we're going to hit these targets? Do you think that there will be public pressure enough to do so? Do you think that maybe there's possibly labor action that farmers can take? I just want to get your approach to this situation.
So the current trajectory indicates we will not meet the targets. We will not address the infrastructure needs and the needs of the farmers to adapt quickly enough. And you're right, it sounds alarmist, but if it's an emergency, if the house is on fire and you're not getting the fire department there, you gotta sound alarmist, right? And as a scientist, I feel like that's my responsibility. We have been sounding the alarm since the 80s, and no one has been acting.
I kind of want to bring this a little bit closer to home. Like you said, a lot of constituents aren't at least immediately affected, or affected in a way that is a one-to-one. Like, prices may go up, but with a lot of other factors, prices at the grocery store have been going up. My question is, at what point is Canada's food supply directly affected? It doesn't sound like it's going to happen anytime soon where there won't be food available, but this seems like a real concern with the trajectory I've seen.
Yeah, I mean, it really depends on what kind of food you're talking about. So, we are a major exporter of grains, pulses. I don't see that our food security in that area is at stake, but what's at stake is global food security, that the reliance on our canola, on our pulses, like that has real impacts for other parts of the world. In terms of other commodities, our reliance on fruits and vegetables, that certainly is at stake at this point. We import a sizable amount of fruits and vegetables into Canada, and we're not doing a great job of developing local food systems. And even for the local production, we're not developing the strategies quick enough to help them adapt the infrastructure required for that adaptation.
So I just want to get a little clarification on this. It sounds like Canada does have the capacity, if needed, to foster local food production to kind of compensate, but where we're at now doesn't.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, right now we're used to eating lettuce year round. We're bringing in lettuce from California Central Valley and Salinas Valley during the winter, and places in Mexico. We could be using our croplands to produce vegetables other than salad and freeze them for the wintertime. We don't have to have year-round fresh fruits and vegetables to meet our dietary needs. If we were to build capacity in terms of processing of those vegetable products, we certainly could be much more food self-sufficient across the country. But the reality is we have a harsh winter. We can't, you know, there's lots of work being done right now on indoor production. I think that will put a dent in some areas. Maybe we'll be able to grow our lettuce indoors. But for the vast majority of our demands, I think that's, it's going to be a long time before that's a possibility. And I think, you know, there's some serious energy constraints that go along with that. Absolutely, we can't be pumping more carbon dioxide into the atmosphere to make that happen.
All right, so it's been a lot of, alarmist, but quite frankly, sobering analysis here. I kind of want to know, is there reason to be hopeful? What positives are happening right now?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I use BC as the canary in the coal mine example of, you know, all these are all the things that are that we've been talking about will happen from climate change are now happening in BC, but also BC is a great example of mobilization. So there's been an organization in BC driven by producers called the Climate and Agriculture Initiative. It's now transformed, been taken over by the BC Ministry of Agriculture. It really has done a great job of doing regional impact assessments on climate change and engaging with stakeholders to better understand what the challenges are likely to be and what their priorities are, and then mobilizing some action in those regions that are regionally specific and commodity specific, which is exactly what's needed. So I think we are a great example of that. We also have the BC Agricultural Climate Action Research Network, so a group of scientists across the province working at government and university institutions, working together to try to address some of the research needs of the agricultural producers. So there's some action being taken, and I am certainly hopeful that we can mobilize. We can tackle some of these challenges. A lot of it is not rocket science. When we're talking about irrigation infrastructure, we don't need fancy sensors to tell us that the crops need water if we don't have access to water. So we know how to build irrigation infrastructure. We just got to put the money and the people power towards it. And that comes back to, you know, what we were talking about earlier in terms of the challenges for policymakers. You're building irrigation infrastructure for 10 to 30 years down the road. And, you know, that's a pretty tough sell for a policymaker to make to constituents today who are facing all sorts of financial constraints.
So it sounds like there is hope if you know, pressure comes and the right moves are made.
Absolutely. We can, I mean, that's the most frustrating thing about this. Like we can tackle this problem. It's just, we've got to put our effort into it.
All right. Well, thank you for speaking with me, Professor Smuckler.
Yeah, you bet. My pleasure.
host Scott Martin and Sean Smuckler in conversation. To read Scott's full piece on the state of agriculture in the face of climate change in Canada, please visit rabble.ca. Switching gears now, here is Rabble editor Nick Seabrook to catch us up on the top news stories of the week in a segment we like to call In Case You Missed It. Take it away, Nick.
Thanks, Brianne. This week, the Ontario Progressive Conservative government is refusing to stop its pillaging of the Greenbelt. The Greenbelt is 2 million acres of land in Ontario that is protected from development. Prior to becoming premier, Doug Ford said that he would not touch the Greenbelt. Scandal erupted over the summer, as not only did Ford remove some land from the Greenbelt, but the land to be removed had been done at the behest of wealthy developers, with direct access to the Office of Municipal Affairs and Housing Minister Steve Clark. Clark resigned in the wake of the scandal this past weekend, but his successor, Paul Calandra, said that while the Greenbelt will be reviewed, he would not rule out even further development of this protected green space. A report released by Ontario's Auditor General last month showed that no Greenbelt land was needed for development for the government to reach its goal of building 1.5 million homes by 2031. Staying in Ontario, the current race for the Ontario Liberal leadership shows starkly different potential futures for the party that once dominated Ontario politics. Bonnie Crombie, Mayor of Mississauga, said that if elected leader, she would govern the party from the center-right. Crombie has also received the largest amount of donations than any other candidate in the race by far. By contrast, fellow candidate Nate Erskine-Smith is pitching a brand of more progressive leadership. He says that if he becomes premier, he would seek to ensure that all Ontarians have access to 12 hours of mental health talk therapy. He's also the only candidate that has made labor an issue on his platform by promising to ban scab workers and enact a gig worker bill of rights, amongst other things. The Ontario Liberal Party will elect a new leader on December 2nd. In labor news, Rabble labor reporter Gabriela Kaluge-Kasuga reports that migrant workers are being left out of programs to support those affected by this summer's many wildfires, and that many have lost their work opportunities as well. Dignidad Migrante is an organization of migrant workers that fights for improved conditions for temporary foreign workers. The organization is calling for open work permits and expanded employment insurance measures for migrant workers. Temporary foreign workers are migrant workers whose livelihoods are tied to a specific job and employer, leaving them vulnerable to abuse. If their job no longer exists, they must quickly apply for a new work permit for a new job or face deportation. Wildfires have burned millions of acres of land in Canada this year, displacing thousands of people. In environmental news, planting trees can be a fun summer job for young people in Canada, but Rabble Assistant Editor Georgia Kelly reports that many of these jobs are paid for by the logging industry, who do more harm to Canadian forests than good. Forest lands are emitting more and more carbon than they sequester. Logging operations, decaying biomass those operations leave behind, along with increasing wildfires and insect outbreaks, all factor into this increase. Much of Canada's natural forest lands are coniferous, populated by evergreen species like the black spruce. After logging companies chop down a section, planters will come and plant black spruce saplings to replace it. But there is a strong chance that most of these saplings will die. The large swaths of wide-open, clear-cut land left behind by industrial logging operations expose the dirt to sunlight and air. Those growing conditions are unfavorable for the types of trees that are being replanted. Are you a journalist at the beginning of your career with a passion for social justice? Rabble is now accepting applications for the 2023-2024 Jack Layton Journalism for Change Fellowship. This four-month-long fellowship supports emerging Canadian journalists who are enthusiastic about social justice forward reporting. To apply, please send a cover letter indicating why you should be the Jack Layton Journalism for Change Fellow together with your resume, feature pitch, and two writing samples to internships@rabble.ca. Your feature pitch should be a story you would like to develop during your time as a fellow and must be centered in social justice. Here's a message from Kia Lucero, our Jack Layton Journalism for Change Fellow from last year.
My name is Kia Lucero, and I'm the Jack Layton Journalism for Change Fellow for winter of 2022 to 2023. Going through this fellowship allowed me to find out who I wanted to be as a journalist while looking introspectively at how to fulfill this role with compassion and honesty. Working on my feature piece, I was able to dive deeper into the complexities of the temporary foreign worker program. Rabble opened up the space for me to investigate the inadequacies and oppression of these systems. The Jack Layden Journalism for Change Fellowship is for anybody who is passionate about social justice, dismantling systemic oppression, and finding solutions. I encourage anybody who is passionate about any of these things to apply.
For more details on your application and your time as a fellow, please visit rabble.ca/journalismforchange. Please note entries close September 22nd at midnight. And finally, as a part of our Rabble Rousers to Watch series of 2023, meet the folks over at Seniors for Climate Action Now. Here is the co-chair of Seniors for Climate Action Now, Liba Spring.
Hi, I'm Liba Spring from Seniors for Climate Action Now. We're calling for emergency climate action at all levels of government in Canada as part of building the global mass climate emergency movement. Through alliances and coalitions, we demonstrate, educate, and rabble-rouse to move the needle on the climate crisis we're in. We are thrilled to be named a rabble-rouser to watch for in 2023 and would like to thank Rabble's readers for nominating us. For more information on the work we do, check out my interview on rabble.ca.
Thanks, Liba. To read her full interview as well as access the full version of all of the stories we talked about today, please visit rabble.ca.
Rabble.ca shares news for the rest of us. We believe news for the rest of us is about creating a more informed and connected world. Help Rabble.ca make quality, progressive news and views accessible to all. Become a Rabble Rouser today and support us during our summer fundraiser with a one-time or monthly donation.
That's it for Rabble Radio this week. Thanks as always for tuning in. If you like the show, please consider subscribing to our show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And please rate, review, share Rabble Radio with your friends. It takes 2 seconds to support independent media like Rabble. If you have feedback for the show, ideas, stories, opinions you'd like us to cover, we'd love to hear about it. Get in touch with us anytime at editor@rabble.ca. Thank you to all the journalists and writers who contributed to this week's content on rabble.ca, and thank you to Carl Nierenberg for supplying the music. Lastly, thank you to you for tuning in to Rabble Radio. I'm Brianne Doyle, and I'll talk to you next week.